Tēnā koutou, welcome to season 5 of the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. I'm Karen Hay. The writers this season have spent decades in the pursuit of creativity and the art of writing, encountering resistance and criticism, personal tragedies, praise and success. It's going to be a great season. I'm glad you can join us. In 2016, Marilyn Duckworth won the Prime Minister's Award for Literary Achievement in Fiction. The award came more than 50 years after she'd won the New Zealand Literary Fund Award for Achievement in 1963. Together, they bookend the career that Marilyn has carved out for herself as novelist, poet, and short story writer. Marilyn's from a family of female writers, as she explained to Deborah Shepherd, her sister, Fleur Adcock, who'll be in later episodes this season, and her mother were also writers.
She was a member of the Women Writers Association in England, and then back here at the Women Writers Association, was different, very different thing. I think it might have been called the Women Writers Circle in England, and here it was the Women Writers Association.
And what did that mean? Did they meet regularly?
Well, they were women who got together and were all trying to write stuff, and some of them did, and a lot of them did. A few didn't get published, but they were all doing pretty well, really. And they'd meet quite often in my mother's house, our house.
Right. So that was an even more of an example of women.
It was.
Showing that writing was a good thing to do.
Yes. Oh, yes. Well, that was the message I got all the time, that writing was wonderful, and that writers were real people, and you could do it if you tried. The only thing I was told by my mother was that there might be trouble getting it published because of the paper shortage. That was the only limitation that I was offered.
Was the paper shortage to do with the war?
To do with the war, yes, to do with the war. Of course, they were all, paper was being used to make, parachutes, and we had to collect paper in England, and we'd go around collecting spare paper.
What did your father think of the writing, of both your mother's writing and your writing?
Well,
childhood, what was his attitude?
He also wanted to, I think, to be a poet, probably more than anything.
Right.
He wanted to write creatively, but he wrote, of course, books on psychology, and that was what he did.
Yes.
But he respected writing, and he always would encourage me to read. And when he found me reading Daphne du Maurier, he'd send me off to read Thackeray or something. he thought that wasn't right, despite the fact that one of the du Maurier novels, I remember Fleur and I were very interested in it,
yes.
The Parasites, and it was it was one of her really better books, and we were interested in this very privileged and dependent parasitical family.
Right.
And my mother told us to stop talking, go to bed. So we said we were going to bed, and then we got out and went walking around the block talking about it till late in the night.
What age was that? Was that here in New Zealand?
This was here in New Zealand. Mm. I was living in Miramar. We were in Miramar until I was 15.
So sometime there. As children, you told each other stories in bed at night?
Always, yes. That was how you went to sleep, I thought. That was just normal.
Yeah.
But, and in fact, I did eventually always fall asleep first. I'd usually begin... One day I went for a walk in the woods and then didn't know what was going to happen next, but something always did. And then Dreamland, the land that we invented, and all the characters, some of them I came up with the names for them and their characteristics, and Fleur came up with other people.
What were some of them?
Well, there was Mrs. Frederick Gillis was one of mine, and she was, I think she was the headmistress of the school, which was called the Eagle's Nest, and all the kids were arranged in classes that were named after birds. I was in robins and Fleur was in starlings. And then gradually Fleur wanted, as she got older, to go to the Land of Happy Meetings, which was in the Enchanted Forest. And we took our way through the trees with kind of walking sticks. I don't why we did that. And she wanted to meet boys and friends.
Yes.
And make friends. But I was more interested in the school and the hijinks and rebelling against teachers. That was my thing.
You and Fleur in your writing, you used to compete with each other you were writing stories for the children's page.
Oh, yes.
And there was a bit of competition.
Oh, a lot of competition at that point, yeah.
Yeah. But you were the first to get published.
My novel, yes, came out way before Fleur's first book of poems. But I was shocked. I was surprised that she was taken aback by my having a novel accepted. I thought, but hang on, I knew you would do it eventually, and she was busy being a successful, very successful academic, and I thought that's what she wanted to be.
What was she studying?
Classics. She was classics, and she was also, she started teaching down in Dunedin classics, but decided instead to go to the library and become a librarian, which she did for many years.
Yes. For quite a long period through her writing life, didn't she?
She did. And she really is much better at keeping records of things and doing things efficiently and in a business-like way than me. Mm. I rely so much on my memory, which is not as good as I want it to be anymore, of course.
That's frustrating.
And paper everywhere, that's my...
Was it a shock to you that she ended up living in London and not coming back, and you living here?
It was a shock that she didn't come back. I thought that she'd go and come back, of course. I knew she wanted to go because I also wanted to go. I was desperate for England for years, but I was really trapped by having a family of young children that I was responsible for and couldn't just, pick up and go overseas.
Do you think that Fleur had to do that? She had to move away and develop a life as a poet and not be in competition with you, not be a novelist? What do you think?
I don't think she was the least concerned about being in competition with me. I think she needed to get away from other things that in her life and... Yeah. And she needed England, and, she loved the woods as I did, and it's the thing that we still love, although they're not the same at all. But she needed the wider world, and she needed the history around her, which I also, I was aware of the minute that I came home after I'd married in England and felt the sort of drabness of this place, and something was missing.
Yes, even when you first arrived here, or came back when you were
when I was 11.
Yep, you said it was grubby and homemade looking.
Yeah, it was homemade. That's right, and it felt as if everybody wasn't quite as real as the people that I met in England.
And it didn't have the history.
Yes, it's the history and. We just, people would come here and they didn't seem to have put down their roots, and they built these flimsy houses and everything was temporary. It was the temporariness of this that got me. And I still would like more of that feeling, but of course New Zealand is settling into itself and growing in a way that I love.
I'm curious, your last book was 2007?
Yes.
Playing Friends, and it was published by Random here.
Yes.
Have you been working on anything since?
I've only been working on short stories for a collection and writing poems, but an awful lot of things have been going on in my life and still are. So.
I remember Gaylin Preston making the point to me that if you looked at a male filmmaker's filmography,
yes,
you could never tell from looking at that where the babies were born, if they were fathers. But if you look at a woman's, you can see by the gaps where the domestic life has intruded. And that seems to be very much what happened to you, because you published four novels, first one in 59, 60, 63, and 69, yes. Over the Fence is out. And then there was a gap of 15 years before Disorderly Conduct came out.
Yes, there was a big gap.
And so the first four were all Hutchinson, UK, and then that one was Hodder and Stoughton,
yep.
New Zealand. So what happened in that time? I know there was a collection of poems in 1975, Other Lovers' Children.
Yes.
But is that something around motherhood that this happened?
Definitely, yes. Because I had to be earning my living. I was being a solo mother for quite a bit of that time.
Mm.
And, of course, I had to also feed my children, and so I needed to earn money. So I wrote, you know, stuff for television and radio. Oh,
yes.
And
close to home.
Articles for, yes, Close to Home, which was good for earning money.
Yeah.
And New Zealand Heritage, just, you know, just money earning. Mm. That's what was going on there.
Mm.
Writing a novel, you know, Barbara's Tongue, which was my third novel, I had, by then, my two little girls were getting older.
Yeah.
And I wanted to spend time with them. I sort of needed to talk to them more. I'm a great talker. And so trying to write a novel at the same time, I had the scholarship in letters, and when I was trying to write Barbara's Tongue, and that was difficult, so in the end I went away. I went to Auckland and had a full-time job working at the London Lending Library, as it was called. Then I wrote the novel, just flowed out, and that was quite possible to work.
Yes.
But to be a mother.
Yes.
And also write is much, much harder.
Of course.
And then they were getting older later on, and a couple of them had left home, and that's when I began again. And I was helped also by getting the Monton Fellowship.
Yes.
So I was...
How did that happen?
Fully funded. Well, I applied for it. One of my daughters heard about it while she was here in New Zealand, and she offered to, she said, come. It was when I'd gone to visit Fleur just after my husband had died, first time I'd been back to England. And
this is Dan?
Dan Donovan.
Yes.
Yeah. And she said, why don't you apply for the Monton Fellowship? And I will, she said, she would move in and look after the kids that were at home.
Really?
Just two of them. And because one went to his grandmother. And so, you know.
So, and the two children were at home by then. Was that Dan's children?
By then, no, there were four children, actually. But Mia went to stay with my mother.
Yes.
And Tim, my stepson, the youngest, he went to stay with his grandmother, and Hannah went to stay with a friend, a family friend, and Mike was actually had moved into a flat next door. So, you know,
suddenly you were free to go.
I was going to be free to go to Monton. So I applied, and I got it. My amazement! I was lucky again. And it made me much more confident, and I thought, oh, well, I can do it now. I should get into it now. There's no excuse.
Yes.
I had started already to write after Dan died, because
That was a terrible time for you.
It was an awful time. And
awful loss.
There was a novel that I had started, and I was sort of halfway into, but I didn't ever finish it. When I went back to read it, I couldn't remember writing the last chapter. It was completely new to me.
Really?
And, you know, it's like suddenly you lose your memory, like shock treatment.
Yes.
It's just gone.
Yes. Very, very tough. Because there were... I'm struck by the losses in your life of two significant people.
A lot of
and
significant
how if
people.
You hadn't lost... Richie, and you hadn't lost Dan, well, life would have been quite different for you, I think.
It certainly would, but especially with Dan, yes.
Hmm.
And, yes, there's been a lot of loss, but then I've lived a long time now, so it's not surprising anymore, but at the time it was.
Yeah, yeah. So in that year, that 15-year gap, were you wishing all through that, wanting to write and feeling frustrated? What was it like?
I was feeling frustrated the whole way through. I began several times a novel and discarded it because I had actually a scholarship in 1972, and I went to Auckland and wrote a novel called Split, which never saw the light of day. I suppose I have a copy of it, I can't remember. Anyway, it was not very well digested material,
right,
because I sort of couldn't get back into
writing. Too many distractions.
A lot of distractions. It was all about distraction,
yes.
1972.
Yeah.
But it was an interesting year because that was the year when feminism seemed to...
Germaine Greer came,
and it was... she certainly made an impression on me, and because I'd been really pretty much unaware of feminism until, the then, or the late 60s at least. It was women's lib, you know.
Mm, true.
Sue Kedgley and...
Yep.
Those people.
In Disorderly Conduct, I just think that is such a great record of what it was like for a mother with the elder children and the younger children and all of them competing for your attention,
yes,
constantly needing your love and attention,
yep,
the struggle of it all. It made me think a lot of Sylvia Sadell's work, you know, the ones with the washing machine or clothes would be all writhing.
Yes,
you know,
wonderful stuff.
Yeah, well, your writing is like that.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, it is. It's a really good record of that period. And
yeah. Well, I had written Rest for the Wicked, partly in Molton, before Disorderly Conduct came out. But the publisher in the UK, the branch of Hodder there, because they'd sort of do it jointly sometimes, they wouldn't take it on. And so initially...
What was their reason?
Hodder here... well, it was plotless, you see. Disorderly Conduct was a plotless novel, I said. And so Hodder here, they didn't dare to do it on their own initially.
Right.
But when I'd done Disorderly Conduct, Bert Hingley came back to me and said he would publish Disorderly Conduct and possibly later on do Rest for the Wicked. So eventually Rest for the Wicked saw the light of day.
Yeah. So you wrote Rest for the Wicked on the Monton? And then came back and wrote Disorderly Conduct.
And hang on, I wrote Married Alive and then Disorderly Conduct. So Disorderly Conduct, they were all published out of order of the way in which I wrote them, so it makes it complicated.
Yeah. What's amazing looking here at the book, the books, it goes 84, 85, 86, 87, 89. You know, that was a very creative period, wasn't it?
It was.
You were making up for lost time.
I was making up for lost time, and I was getting encouragement from my publisher, Bert, who, he acted quite often more or less as my agent, although I did have an agent later on. I'd begun with an agent, Ray Richards, here.
Yes.
But he didn't manage to get Married Alive and Disorderly Conduct published somehow. So eventually it happened and I decided to do it on my own. And without an agent.
Yeah.
But I've had an agent since.
Right.
I've had two agents.
Who have they been?
I had Dinah Wiener in England, who, when Seeing Red, when my first novels that were published by Random came out, I had Dinah Wiener. And then I switched to Curtis Brown, Tim Curnow in Australia, who wrote wanting me to transfer, so I transferred to him.
And that worked out well?
And yes, it did. But he was very good, very businesslike. And but then he retired. I'm still Curtis Brown.
Right.
And with Tara. But I, you know, it doesn't make a lot of difference. I know that these days an agent is, you know, the person that you need first to get anywhere.
Yes.
And it's a completely different scene, publishing. It's so much more about selling books and the business-like side of it and promotion and...
being on Facebook and websites.
All that stuff, yeah. It's a completely different scene. And my daughter, Mia, who's a novelist in England, busy completing her second novel.
Right.
And
she's done a master's in creative writing over there.
Yes, she did. That's what you do these days, you see. Yeah. You do master's in creative writing.
Yeah.
And she found it very useful because she belongs to writing groups and they criticise each other. Mm-hmm. It's totally not the way I wanted to be a writer.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to shut myself away.
Yes.
Yep. As people, I thought, did, and that was why I chose that
profession. I like your model, actually, of doing it. And you also talked about how editors have a much bigger role to play now in publishing than they did in the early days with your novels.
Certainly.
Can you explain that? Like, say with A Gap in the Spectrum and A Barbara's Tongue, how much editing happened to those?
Well, there was editing. I remember I was told to remove the real name of a restaurant in Soho and, you know, things like that. And there was a bit on a train that I found interesting, which they said, could they leave that bit out? And I said, oh, yes, sure. Mm-hmm. And why don't you use your own name? Because I wasn't going to even use my own name at that point. So eventually I used my own name.
That's good. What were you going to be called?
Rachel Worth, I think. I don't know. Or was it Jane? Anyway, because I wanted a sort of a brisk, plain name instead of my silly little Marilyn name that I'm stuck with.
Mm.
And I'm stuck with my first married name because I'd written three novels by then. And
so they weren't fiddling with your sentence construction? Or
No, they weren't doing that.
Much bigger, more structural edit.
Yeah, and being careful for, you know, getting into trouble from...
Libel
and that kind of thing, but that was all that mattered there. But also, you see, they were so far away in London that it wasn't a good idea to try and communicate, and speed of communication was so much slowed down. I mean, it was sort of nearly 6 weeks on the water before my manuscript arrived, and so...
Really different days. So then, more recently, with, say... Playing Friends or Stud Muffin, Swallowing Diamonds. So by then you had Harriet Allen.
I had Harriet Allen,
yes. So what did that mean for you, the editing?
Well, I had very good copy editing done, and some ideas came from very good editors, but I resisted, I'm afraid, most.
Good on you.
But I did take on board some suggestions of what to write perhaps a bit more about and write a bit less about.
I'm Karen Hay, and this is the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. We'll be back to the podcast in a moment, but we want to remind you that the NZSA is the professional representative body which lobbies for the rights of all authors in New Zealand. NZSA will be representing writers in the ongoing reviews of the 2019 Copyright Act and campaigning for a stronger public lending right. NZSA collaborates across the sector to raise the visibility and discoverability of local books and local writers. To learn more about these important issues and to find out how to become a member, visit authors.org.nz. Each writer has their own way of approaching the page. In 2015, Deborah Shepherd asked Marilyn Duckworth about what a day of writing is like for her.
A writing day, they were only ever writing weeks. You know, I wouldn't have the odd day being a writer. I'd go away for hopefully about 3 months would be good, but 6 weeks would be good as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd really set myself goals, you know, 2,000 words a day kind of thing, just simple things like that, disciplining myself to do stuff, and I'd get up, I'd eat something, and I'd start writing, and I'd keep writing, and then I'd stop, eat something, and then go on writing, and then I'd watch, say, half an hour of Coronation Street if I had a TV where I was, and then on with the writing, and writing, and sometimes I'd then start putting it onto, typing it onto a, mm-hmm. a computer if I was at a computer stage, or typewriter if I wasn't.
There was a description of you writing something very fast and your husband waking and finding you writing illegibly on the floor.
Oh, that's right. I dream things, you see, and so I'd have to get up and write. I actually wrote a short story sort of in the dark on the floor, which I had trouble deciphering, but I did write the novel.
You did?
I mean, the story, I think it was rather a naughty story called Kerry Hume's Hat.
Kerry Hume's Hat?
Yes.
Did it get published?
No, I've still got it, but I think it wouldn't be very politically correct. And so, but, you know, you have to write if the writing's there, bursting to get out.
So, you're the third author now that I've interviewed, and what I'm struck by is all the projects that get written and don't get published.
Oh, yes, well, I've done that too, but because there are always rejection letters of various kinds, but most of the things are I had a lot of rejections from English publishers. They even rejected stuff that later was published.
Yeah.
So, but you know, you have to go through the rejection process in the first place, and it's just something that you just climb over the hurdle and
but it's hard though,
it's
isn't
hard.
It?
And getting bad reviews. I mean, the thing is, once you've finished a novel, it's as if you've shed a skin. You're not just putting the novel aside, you're putting your skin aside.
Mm.
So you're a bit raw, and then yes. The reviews come to your raw skin, and the best thing is shove it in a drawer and then read it a month later, and actually you think, oh, actually that wasn't bad, you know.
Do you remember the good reviews, though?
I do, and I've had reviews that, you know, the kind of reviews that are useful quoting, like V.S. Naipaul saying that my dialogue was a joy, and I loved that. And
well, that sets
that was
you up
in
for
the
life.
TLS.
Yes.
Yes.
Doesn't that set you up for life, something like that?
Yes. And I
that was early that you got that.
That was with A Gap in the Spectrum.
Yeah.
And I thought, goodness. So,
that was something to hold on to through that long 15-year period where you were waiting to write
again?
Oh,
yes. Well, I really, you know, I wondered if I would ever do it again, but I did. But it was partly the Monton Fellowship that made me.
What was the Monton Fellowship like that year?
Oh, it was just fabulous. It was only $4,000 in those days. It went up to $8,000 the next year when Loris Edmund got it, which is fine. But $4,000 to me was riches. My 15-year-old daughter, Mia, who was a French scholar, her father paid for her to come and visit me there for, it was only 3 weeks that she was there, I think, but she wasn't actually living with me in the room, and I'd finished what I was working on, which was good, and Tony Vaught looked after us there. Mm. He found a room for her up the road.
How did you find the actual room to work in?
The room, I lived in the room, which was not quite allowed, but not forbidden. It just didn't talk about it, you see. And I said to Loris when she was coming that you've just got to be discreet about what you do. And Loris wasn't as discreet as me, and they came and moved her out. And she had to go somewhere else. But it was all I could afford at the time, really.
Could you see the sea from it?
No. It's down a road and round the corner. You could hear the seagulls, you know, it was sort of, the sea seemed to be there with you, but it actually wasn't. But what the first thing you saw was the railway station, where the trains came past, and you could hear the trains going past at intervals, which didn't bother me a bit. They sort of punctuated my day.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, it was just, I had the room with the little bed, very monastic looking place, mm-hmm. And then you'd have to go outside and round the corner to a little shower and loo, and I was warned to make a noise as I went through the leaves because snakes, there might be a snake, and I did meet a snake once, but...
You said in Camping on the Fault Line that producing a novel was beginning to feel for me like visiting a volcano. You wrote yourself right up to the edge and had to teeter there, waiting for a publisher to choose whether to push you into the boiling lava of rejection or drag you back for another chance at life. That's good. That's very good.
I'd forgotten that, but yes, that's exactly how it felt. Because we are writers at the mercy of publishers, and they control us. But you get used to it. In fact, I didn't ever let them tell me what to write or how to do it, you see. And so that's, to me, what mattered most was writing what I wanted to. And I know old Ray Richards and the various other people, agents, say to you, you know, you've got to write a longer novel. It's got to be this long. It's got to have more characters. It's got to have this. It's got to have that. And I thought, I know it's got to, but I do it this way. And
I just wanted to talk to you about equality issues and being a writer in New Zealand and whether women's writing has at times been marginalised or still is. And I had these quotes. You were referred to as Mrs Duckworth, authoress, not an author.
Yes.
And there was an article which the title was Writes Novels at Kitchen Table.
Oh, yes.
And it said, a Wellington housewife has discovered that though her hands may be too often in the sink, her thoughts may, to advantage, soar in less mundane directions. Slight, golden-haired Mrs. H. Duckworth, mother of two enchanting Dresden-like baby daughters, is surely one of the youngest to join the ranks of successful novelists.
That's a classic.
That's
a sample of the times. How did we live like that?
What was the effect of it on you? It's patronising.
It was totally patronising, but I was just thrilled that I was in the paper.
Yes.
I mean,
what was the paper? You didn't.
It'd be the Evening Post.
Right. So there was that going on, the put downs and so on. But at the same time, other women writers were emerging. There was quite a group of you.
There was quite a group around that same time.
Sue McCauley, Fiona Kidman, Joy Cowley.
They came later than first, when I was doing it. It was just, there was Sylvia Ashton Warner and there was
Ruth France
and me, and that was pretty much it. Robin Hyde was passed, all those people, real people.
Yeah.
But then the next wave came with Fiona and Sue McCauley and stuff. Sue McCauley came out as a trade paperback. I think she might have been the first one, the sort of quality paperback that Bert Hingley was publishing. And it was a very fertile time for New Zealand writing. And bookshops suddenly had New Zealand stands. And, there was so much going on.
This is the 80s.
The 80s. That was the liveliest.
Corn time.
Definitely the liveliest time. And it continued into the 90s, and then started fading off.
Yeah. Just looking at the New Zealand Society of Authors, you joined them in either 1959 or 1960?
1959. I thought it was 60. I think I said 60, but I was told I joined in 1959, so it was 1959.
Yeah. And why did you join?
I joined because I was asked. You had to be asked. Mm-hmm. There was no way you could apply or anything like that. And so there was a feeling that you joined a certain elite, and that is a draw card.
Yes. So it was an honour to be asked.
It was an honour to be asked, and I felt very honoured.
And you edited the Penn newsletter?
Yes, I did for a while. I can't remember how long I did that for, but which was a completely different animal from what we've got now, which is much smarter and much more interesting,
mm-hmm.
and with wonderful design and photographs and everything.
You're talking about the New Zealand Author that now comes out.
Yes.
It's a quarterly, is it? I think quarterly. You were 24 years old when you were asked to be a member. Yeah.
Yeah. I might have even been 23, I suppose, but...
59.
It's vague.
Yeah. And the committee was mostly male, apart from the poet Ruth Gilbert.
Yes.
And there was Pat Lawler's response to your book, A Gap in the Spectrum, which
he was being a man, and he'd liked Light Cakes for Tea, who'd been one of the new authors in that imprint, had been a very harmless,
mm-hmm.
nice book, the kind of nice ladies' book that ladies should write.
Mm-hmm. Did Penn have an influence on your writing life?
Who?
Penn.
Penn. It had an influence in that, well, really it just helped my confidence and helped me to get into conversation with practicing writers of both sexes, mostly male. It does something for your confidence, which is something that I was certainly lacking, and I think writers quite often are. Mm. Although they've got enormous egos, we've all got enormous egos, but we keep it well hidden.
So were you involved in any of the campaigns, like the around the Authors Fund and Public Lending Right?
Public Lending Right, yes, I was, and I knew that was a good thing, but it was Ian Cross who did all the work. He and I went together for a meeting in Parliament with somebody.
Yeah.
And but he did it. It took a while, but it happened in 73. And
has that helped you, the Public Lending Right?
Oh yes, it's been sometimes my main income apart from when I've been on other stuff. But the income is going down. For a while there, it looked as though it would start moving up when Helen Clark was doing the right things, but. It's sort of pretty static and now moving down, but it moved down for me, of course, because it depends on the number of books you've got in libraries that all around the country.
That's true, yes.
And I'm a lot of, some of me are sitting in the stack room. I was shocked that Henry Green, who was one of my favourite authors, writing about, early Graham Greene time,
mm-hmm.
and... He's in the stack room, I think. Or maybe he's not even there. I was shocked at how many people, writers, that if you go back to the library looking for them,
mm-hmm.
they aren't there anymore. They're in the stack room.
I had this quote from John Pascoe saying there's not much joy in spending a lot of time administering a writer's organisation instead of writing as such. You felt that way?
I certainly felt that way, and so I'm afraid I haven't been... as useful as I might have been. I was a very fairly silent committee member, but after the committee, the real business ended, then I'd start talking, because you'd hang around and talk. We did much more
mm-hmm.
hanging around and talking about things.
So do you think it's a good... it advocates well for writers?
It does do some really good things, and certainly, you know, the standardising of and raising of fees that writers can expect. Still not great, but it's much better than it used to be. Those things are very good, and I think if you ask for advice for contracts and things, you get the good advice from them.
You've been listening to parts of an oral history interview between Deborah Shepherd and Marilyn Duckworth, recorded for the New Zealand Society of Authors in 2015 and used here on the New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. You can find episodes from past seasons and be notified when the next episode is available by subscribing to the podcast on SoundCloud or wherever you listen. This podcast was produced by Elizabeth Kirkby-McLeod for the New Zealand Society of Authors, with audio support from Yana Tanahu Owen. Notturno by Ottorino Respighi, which you're listening to now, is performed by Justin Bird. I'm Karen Hay, and this was a New Zealand Society of Authors Oral History Podcast. Ka kite anō, oia koutou.